those handouts. There are some extras up here. Just help yourself or raise your hand if you're so inclined, and someone like Lowell will do it. I don't see any hands yet, so maybe we've got everybody covered. Okay. We were talking and trying to finish up Daniel chapter 9, which is a rather important and I don't want to say it's a difficult one to understand, but getting the starting dates and pulling that all together is usually what gives people the most difficulty. There's not a whole lot of disagreement. There is some, but not a whole lot of disagreement on the interpretation of those passages, but when to start it and when to end it, there is. And I was thinking last night driving to Betty and Carol's that may not be all unintentional. It seems to me like God gives us things so to show us clearly that He knows what's going to happen, that He's in charge. But when it comes to New Testament dates in particular, there's some reason He didn't tell us the exact year that Jesus was born, the exact year that He was crucified, and it may have to deal with the transition from the law to the New Testament covenant, where dates and places aren't to be commemorated in the New Testament in the same sense that they were in the Old Testament. The Jews had specific feasts, and they were told exactly when to do it, the month and the day, and other than the first day of the week, we don't have that in the New Testament. So that may be part of the reason there. But I did say that we would start there, and if anybody has a question or a comment on chapter 9 or anything we talked on last night, I want to start by giving you an opportunity to do that. Anything you might disagree with or would like clarification on? Yeah, and I said I'd save it, but I changed my mind because I wanted to put something else on there. But if you've got your chart like this, we can talk off of that. Okay. Now, Marvin asked a real good question last night, and I didn't give him as good an answer as I wanted to because I had to do a little checking. And his question, if I remember it, was, or well, at least one of his questions was, were the priests always 30 when they began? And I did a little looking on this, and that certainly is the norm. The priest duration of service would be the 20 years from 30 to 50. And he talks about that back in Numbers chapter 4, verse 3. But I might give you another couple of passages if you're interested in it, and I don't know whether you are, in Numbers chapter 8 and verse 24, the age for the Levites to serve in the temple is 25. And when you get to 1 Corinthians chapter 23, there's reference to it being 20. 30 was the norm, but there do appear, to me anyway, to be a few exceptions to that. Now, why these exceptions were in place, I don't know. It may have to do with at various times there were fewer or lesser Levites available to serve the tabernacle or the temple. The one in First Chronicles is the transition from the tabernacle to the temple. And there may have been something to do with that. I read a few commentaries on it, and they didn't give me a fully satisfactory reason for why some of those differences, and we may not be totally explained, but 30 was by far the defined. And then they could serve up until they're 50. Of course, that excludes the high priest. He served until his death. Marvin, did you have some? 23. If you'd like to, we can look at that. In 1 Chronicles 23, and there's a lot of advantages to being away from home, but one of them is you don't have all your library with you. In 1 Chronicles 23, verse 3, the Levites were numbered from the age of 30 years and upward, and they found there were 38,000. That would be men. And then if you notice in verse 24, the last part of that, it says, and the names of those that did work for the service of the house of the Lord from the age of 20 years and upward And then that's repeated again in verse 27, the reference to 20 years and upward. Now, just to what extent they served and how they served, I think I would want to do a little bit more digging before I gave a definitive answer. But I wanted to add those scriptures to it because it was a good question. And I do believe, as I think most of you, that 30 was the typical year, but there may have been, and I think there were a few occasions where that was modified for whatever reason. Maybe there just weren't enough Levites at various times, or there weren't enough close to the temple. That may have been one of the reasons when they started that. But that's not essential to the understanding of Daniel. I just thought it was a loose end that I didn't feel like I tied together very well last night. Any other comments or questions? Lowell.
Last night you talked about Christ being born about 4 B.C.
Well, no later than 4 B.C. I think he was probably born in 5 or 6 B.C. Because 4 B.C. is when Herod the Great died, so he was probably 1 or 2 years by then because they'd gone to Egypt and Herod had killed all the babies under 2 and that's when they came back. Go ahead. I don't have anything profound on there. As I understand it, when the AD BC thing was put up, they just didn't really understand when he was born, and they just missed. They just missed. One of the things that happens, though, I don't want to get hung up in this. If you take him being born in BC 6, and then say his ministry began at 30. Then you place his death 3 years later. You start moving his death down further into the 27s and 6 AD. And that can cause you a problem. And I'll tell you what the problem is. We know that the Passover, how that interrelated with his crucifixion. Well, Passover wasn't on the same day of the week. Passover is like, it was the 14th of Nisan. And any time it's the 25th of December or the 14th of Nisan, every year it rotates around. So sometimes Passover would be on our Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday. If you back that number down too low, you get a Passover that's too early in the week for him to have been in the grave only 3 days, and you start having him in the grave 4 days and 5 days to have him raised on the first day. So it gets more complicated than it appears on the surface. So I did want to comment on that, or at least make you aware of that. Okay, any other comments or questions on that? And we'll, if we have time at the end, which we never do, we'll come back to anything in the whole book. Okay, nothing? Daniel chapter 10. Really, chapters 10, 11, and 12 are one unit. There's really one vision that we're going to be dealing with tonight, and that's Daniel's last vision. And it actually begins in chapter 11, verse 2, and will conclude in chapter 12, verse 3. And chapter 10 is really an introduction to this vision, and then the latter part of chapter 12 is kind of a conclusion or an adding of a few things before the book is culminated. But it's really that vision. And we won't go through this vision verse by verse because you really need to diagram it to get every which king it was, but we can get the main focus out of it. And I'd rather us leave with an understanding of what the vision was about and what it was telling us rather than taking it verse by verse. But let's go to Daniel chapter 10. I believe this vision came somewhere around 536 B.C. We're told that it's in the third year of Cyrus. And Cyrus came in 539, if this is the third year that Cyrus was over the Babylonian Empire, I'll put it that way. But be that as it may, this was a very troubling time for Daniel. In verse 1, it said about halfway through, the thing was true, but the time appointed was long in the King James. Long is not a real good translation there. It has to do with long in terms of worrisome. This is a very troubling vision for Daniel. And when you begin to see what this vision is about And it's a vision about what's going to happen to the Jews, particularly by some of the countries that grew out of the Grecian Empire, we can see. It was so bad that Daniel was in mourning for 3 full weeks, according to verse 2. I ate no pleasant bread, neither came flesh or wine to my mouth, neither did I anoint myself at all for this whole 3 weeks. This was probably a period not only of mourning, but also of meditation and focus, getting ready to accept this particular vision. Verse 5, I'd like to comment on that. Daniel says, I lifted up my eyes and looked and beheld a certain man clothed in linen. I've heard it debated ad infinitum whether this was an angel or whether this was a Christophany. Now, Christophany is simply Christ appearing in the Spirit. And some people think this was a Christophany, which means Christ actually appeared, not in the flesh, because that couldn't be, because then we'd have Christ coming twice. I tend to think this was an angel. But I throw the other one out because you'll hear people say that. And if it were a Christophany, it would not violate anything else in the Bible, and it would not negate that Christ only came to this earth in flesh and bones once and died. So I don't see that it would negate or contradict anything. But I think usually when a man comes from heaven and appears to man, it's usually an angel in a man's appearance, has been my experience and my understanding. Now, some of the reason why people think this is a Christophany, though, is verse 6. His body was like beryl, and his face was like the appearance of lightning. His eyes were lamps of fire. His arms and feet were like the color of polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. And if you'll just listen, let me read what John saw in Revelation chapter 1 when he saw Christ. And his feet were like brass, and they burned like a furnace, and his voice was like the voice of many waters. Earlier it talks about his eyes were as flame of fire. So there are some similarities. I'll leave that for your conclusion, because I don't think it really matters. I've given you my opinion, and we'll just leave it there for right now. Daniel in verse 7 says, he alone saw the vision. Drop down to verse 13, if you will. I just want to point a few things out. This isn't the vision yet. This is just the introduction. But in verse 13, we get an interesting insight, one of the few glimpses in the Bible of how angels work. And you'll probably hear me use this passage in about a month, because I'm supposed to talk 1 month from today on angels up here. But in verse 13, it says, the prince of the kingdom of Persia. Now that would be a satanic angel or an evil angel. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me. Now you have to understand who's talking. This is Gabriel talking, the angel. Withstood me 120 days or 21 days, but lo, Michael, one of the chief princes or angels, came and helped me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Now that's really all we're told, but what apparently is occurring is the satanic angels of the angels of Satan and the angels of God are having some kind of a power struggle for the heart and soul of Persia. And Gabriel is in essence saying, I would have been here sooner, but I was tied up fighting off, or fighting with, if you will, the evil spirits that were trying to do damage to the kingdom of Persia. Now, I wish I could tell you more about what's going on, but I can only tell you what's there. But I will tell you that I believe that the angelic spirits, both of Satan and of God, are active. And if we could see all the things that are going on around us, we would be absolutely amazed as they vie to guide us. You know, we use the term guardian angel. I don't like that, but at least ministering angels that are there to help us. Well, I believe there's also satanic angels there, and it's almost like one's tapping on one shoulder and the other one's tapping on the other shoulder, and they're both whispering in our ear, and which way are we going to go? Now, I don't believe, and I don't want to leave the impression, that we're just at the mercy of these angels, because that would negate our free will. But I do believe, and I believe this verse is one of those that indicates it. So I wanted to point that out because there are so few of these kinds of insights into angelic behavior in the Bible. Verse 14, latter days. Now I came to make thee understand what shall befall the people in the latter days. That latter days, as I understand it and believe, is a reference to the latter days of the Mosaic dispensation. So this vision that we're going to see in chapter 11 is what's going to be happening as we near the end of the Mosaic dispensation, or as we approach the coming and death of Christ. That's those same two different ways of saying the same thing. Okay. From verse 19 through 21, we basically have the angel comforting Daniel. It's as if the Lord understood what a terrible toll this would take on Daniel. And we've got the angel comforting. He says in verse 19, "Great, you're a man that's greatly beloved. Don't fear. Be peaceful. Be strong. And when he had spoken unto me, I was strengthened." And he went on. If you'll notice, I got that out of context. This whole chapter is preparing Daniel and introducing us to the vision that we're going to see in chapter 11. Any comments or questions on chapter 10? Again, I don't go through it hurriedly because it's not important. It's beautiful. But it's the kind of stuff that we can read and meditate on ourselves, by ourselves, and get great comfort from it. If we'll let God minister to us through His Word and through our prayers, I think He'll do the same thing for us, basically, that He did for Daniel. We may not see the angel, but that doesn't mean the angelic power is not there to help us. Comments or questions before I move into the vision? Verse 20, a specific thing about it, Clark?
Well, I just don't know how to talk about the prince of Persia on that, because like the prince of
the devil. Yeah, that's Gabriel talking, and after he's done with speaking to Daniel, apparently he's going to have to go back and continue that spiritual struggle for that country in some way, as I understand it. That prince of Persia there, I believe, is the same as the prince of the kingdom of Persia in verse 13, which was a... I'm sorry? Yes. Yes. No, I don't think God's involved with just Persia. I think He's involved with many dealings. He doesn't make them happen, but He's involved in them. In ways we don't understand. In ways I don't understand. Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, let's move into the vision, if you will allow me. And that takes us to chapter 11. And we will go through this a little more specifically, because I'm willing to take 20 or 25 minutes on this passage, if you would like. "Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold," now this is the beginning of the vision. This is what Daniel is being shown. "Behold, there shall stand up yet," these are kings that are yet to come, "three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they." And in fact, there were going to be four kings of Persia before Persia began to really slip. Those of you that are specifically interested in who these kings were, I'll give you their names. Cambyses, Cambyses. He followed Cyrus, so he would be the next. Smerdis, Smerdis. Darius Hystaspes, Hystaspes. And that's the way I pronounce it. I've never heard anyone from Persia say these names, so if you want to pronounce it different, fine. And then there's Xerxes the First. Now you're familiar with Xerxes the First, even though you may not know him by that name. He was Esther's husband. Remember the book of Esther, where he got rid of Vashti? Well, Xerxes or Ahasuerus, in this case, were the same one. So let's kind of get our frame of reference. See, Daniel now is at about 535 B.C., and I've given you a list of four kings that are going to take you down to about 465 B.C. The book of Esther probably occurred somewhere around 480 to 470. It took about 10 years for that book to unfold. So that would have been the range of Esther as she was queen of Xerxes the First. And he is the fourth king here mentioned, at least I believe he's the fourth king that's referred to here in verse 2. Okay. Esther's not necessarily critical, but I like to tie these books together. Now let me tell you something about Xerxes that got him in trouble, and then we're going to go to a verse in the book of Esther to show you how that impacted the story of Esther. Xerxes was going to go and lead a military expedition against the emerging Greek power. It wasn't a power yet, but it was emerging. So he led an army. Can't get it out. He led an army against Greece, and he thought he'd do very, very well, but he didn't do well at all. He got whooped. And he had to come home with his tail between his legs, and that really gave a lot of stimulus to the rise of the Grecian Empire. And then later, when Alexander the Great came along, as we're going to see, he actually conquered the Persian. But in Esther chapter 2, verse 1, there's a reference to what I just said, I believe. And it has a lot to do with the mindset, if you will, of Xerxes. Got to find it first, just a minute. Okay. Now you remember in Esther chapter 1, he was mad at Vashti because she wouldn't come and dance for him. But notice in chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased." Well, the thing that he was mad about was getting whooped in Greece. So between chapters 1 and 2 of Esther, we've got King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, going and trying to defeat some of these Grecian tribes. He wasn't successful because he didn't plan and take them seriously enough, so he was really mad when he came back in Esther chapter 2, and that just gives more fuel to help understand the mindset of this guy when the book of Esther unfolds. Okay, that's really all I want to say about Esther, but I think that's interesting. Okay, verse 3, chapter 11 of Daniel. "And a mighty king shall stand up." Now we're seeing the assault against Persia begin to take shape. And this mighty king, I believe, is Alexander the Great. And we ran into him in the earlier prophecy. So a lot of what we're going to see in chapter 11 is just a further illumination or elucidation of the things that we have been told earlier. Verse 3, "And a mighty king, or Alexander the Great, shall stand up and shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds." Remember, we talked about when Alexander the Great died, his kingdom was divided to his four generals. Same thing. Here it's just saying it's divided to the four winds of heaven and not his posterity. It wasn't his children that inherited it. It was his generals that inherited it. "Nor according to the dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides these." In other words, his kingdom would never be as strong as it was when he ruled it. Now, the beauty of what we're reading is we're not reading history. We're reading prophecy. Daniel is writing down what's going to happen 200 and 300 years later. And as this unfolds, he's eventually going to be writing with great accuracy what's going to happen 500 and 600 years later. That's the import of what we're studying. If this was just history, we could get that anywhere. This is history before it happens, and that's what makes it prophetic and what makes it inspired. Okay. So now we've got in just these verses 2 through 4, we've got the Persian Empire. It's been defeated by Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great's died, And the Grecian Empire is now divided into these four elements, and I told you several times, as it's come up in Daniel, that two of those elements, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, were the two strongest. The Ptolemies were in Egypt, and the Seleucids were in Syria. So you've got these two dominant factors, one's north and one's south, and they're just going to fight for 200 years. And that's what the 11th chapter is all about, these two fighting. I brought the map up here, not because you don't know of it, but I just wanted to, this is Mediterranean Sea, this is Israel. Well, this is Syria, where the Seleucids are. This is Egypt, where the Ptolemies are. And if these two are going to fight, you don't have to be a geographical whiz to know that they're just going to beat a path right through Israel every time they do it. It's just like having two neighbors fighting, and you live in between them. And they just go back and forth, across your yard, across your yard, across your yard. And you're not strong enough to stop them. That's what's going to happen for this next 150 or 200 years.
So when, in verse 5, for instance, it says the king of the south, that's reference to the Ptolemies, which are in Egypt, because that's the south. And then we're going to see all through this chapter references to kings of the north. That's Syria or the Seleucids. So it's not confusing. It's just two countries, and they're just fighting. And one will go down and win, and then he'll go home, and then a year or two later, another one will come up, and he'll win for a while. And it's just, it's kind of like a Chinese fire drill, except no one ever deals a knockout blow, at least for a while. Now, when you read the 11th chapter of Daniel, you can just really get all tangled up. And the king from the south did this, and the king from the north, and the daughter of the king from the north married the king of the south's daughter, and the king of the south's and you can just have all kinds of headaches if you want to. But just keep in mind what's happening. A northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, and they're going to fight for about 200 years, and Daniel's going to walk us right through it. Okay?
Now, the reason I wanted to erase that is I knew you all wanted the kings of the north and the south, so I put them on the board.
No, I don't know. I doubt very many of you really want them.
But as I go through now, chapter 11, I'm going to be talking about Seleucus Nicor. I'm going to be talking about Ptolemy Philadelphia and Ptolemy Epiphanes. I'm going to be talking about Antiochus Theus. I'm going to be talking about Antiochus the Third, or he's sometimes called Antiochus the Great. Of course, we'll end up with Antiochus Epiphanes, which I've already talked about. So maybe that'll help you follow a little bit. It would help me.
Okay, I'll put it that way. And these names aren't used here. It's just the king of the north and the king of the south. And if you don't kind of track how this is coming down through history, it doesn't mean as much to me. But I really want to make sure we get the main idea of what's going on. If you never remember any of these names, that's fine. But if you don't remember that the Seleucids and the Ptolemies were fighting, and they were beating a path through Jerusalem, and it caused great hardship on the Jews, then we've missed the whole point. Okay? And that may happen, but I don't think it needs to. Okay. Let me just kind of start going down here a little bit with you, and I'll point out a few things that I found interesting, and I hope you do too. Verse 5, "And the king of the south, the Ptolemies, shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion, and dominion shall be a great dominion. And in the end of years, they shall join themselves together." Okay, well, let's stop right there. The two kingdoms, and initially the Ptolemies seem to be the strongest. That's what it's telling us there in verse 5, the king of the south. Okay? And this would be right up here, Ptolemy the First, or Ptolemy Soter, and we're at about 323 B.C. as I started both of these charts. Okay? And remember, Alexander the Great died just about then. I think he died in
324, 323. So we're right at the death of Alexander the Great. Okay? One of his princes was... I'm sorry, over here. The princess that was strongest there referred to was actually the king from the north. So we've got these two strong kings starting out. But in verse 6 it says, at the end of their years, or at the end of years, that simply means in the future. At the end of some time in the future, these two decided that they would try to join together. And as you've seen all throughout history in Europe, it's no different here, one of the ways they joined warring kingdoms together was one king would give his daughter to the other king, and you figure if you get married and they have joint grandkids, maybe they'll quit fighting. I'm not sure it works that way all the time, but in theory it does. But it didn't work that way. Okay, the king's daughter, and this is in verse 6, for the king's daughter of the south came up to the king of the north. Now, the king's daughter there was a girl or a lady by the name of Bernice. And she was a little bit further down here, actually the daughter of Ptolemy Philadelphia. So we've actually passed some time here, and that's something that's a little hard to keep track of if you don't have your history book in one hand. So Ptolemy Philadelphia gave his daughter Bernice to Antiochus Theus to marry. Well, he already had a wife, so he had to put his current wife on the back burner. And you can see all kinds of domestic questions arising. Well, the real kicker in this thing is Ptolemy Philadelphia died 2 years after he gave his daughter to Antiochus Theus. At which point, Antiochus decided he wanted his first wife back. So, he had Bernice killed so he could have his first wife back. And then the poor guy wasn't real sharp, I guess, because his first wife saw that he killed Bernice and decided he was crazy, so she had him killed before he killed her. And it's just this... It's not the Keystone Cops, but it almost is. Okay, but that's what verse 6 is referring to. Now let me go back and read verse 6 for you. At the end of the years, they, this is the two kings from the north and the south, shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall become the king of the north, shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain her power. Why? Because he killed her. Neither shall he stand. Why? Because his first wife killed him. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begot her, and he that strengtheneth her of these times. So in other words, that just didn't pan out. Now what happened is, Bernice's brother was upset because they killed Bernice, so he leads a charge from the south up to the north. So let's read verse 7. But out of the branch of her roots, or some of her family, shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against him, and shall prevail. And that's exactly what happened. Ptolemy Euergetus was his son and Bernice's brother, so he comes up to take vengeance on the Seleucids for killing his sister. He didn't get there in time to save her, but he did prevail against Syria and captured a lot of Syria. And that's exactly what it says there. And verse 8, carried a lot of captives down to the north. And the rest of this chapter is just going to be this jockeying, jockeying, jockeying. And the chapter will end with the death of Antiochus Epiphanes, which was the little horn in chapter 8, if you were with us on the night that we dealt with that. Okay, any questions on that before I go through? I'm just going to kind of spend the rest of the time cherry-picking here a little bit to give you a few stories to go with this to let you fill in. Yeah, Jalene?
I have a reference here that says that Bernice was murdered by the former wife.
No, I don't think that's correct. I think it's correct that you have that reference, but I think that reference is wrong. She was actually killed by the guards of Theus. And then she, his former wife, did not kill her. She killed him. It's from Josephus and others. Yeah, Josephus et al. Yes, Mike. Yeah. I pronounce it Cambys, but I don't know that's that. C-A-M-B-Y-S-E-S. Cambyses? Okay. Anybody else? Do you kind of follow what's going on? Okay, there's not going to be any tests. But it is nice to kind of know a little bit about this. It not biblically. I mean, this would be, well, she'd be a little later than this. She'd be down toward here. I can't, which of the Caesars? Mark Antony? Yeah, she, well, see, these overlap, but she'd be more down here. I don't think she wouldn't be up here yet. I don't think. Some of you may have a date for Cleopatra. I don't have one in mind, but I think she'd be a little later, more into the Roman era than now. Rome, all during this time, Rome's starting to build. I mean, these things just don't happen like that. Rome's starting to build. Remember I told you Rome's what came down and embarrassed Antiochus Epiphanes when they said, well, decide before you get out of that circle. So they were pretty strong, but they hadn't defeated them yet. Anybody else? Okay, let's just kind of go through a little bit more. Let me see where it'd be a good one. Verse 19, 17. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. Okay, that's a reference to Antiochus III giving his daughter, and make sure I got these names right, giving his daughter to Ptolemy Epiphanes. So they tried it here, and now we're going to try it again. And the object of this was the same thing. Let's unite these kingdoms. The problem that happened, poor Antiochus the Great gave his daughter to her, thinking she'd soften him up and make him like the Syrians. She fell in love with this guy, which is kind of a crazy thing to do just because you got married, I guess. And she started being loyal to the Ptolemies instead of the Syrians. And that all fell apart. She kind of double-crossed her dad, I guess, even though her dad really didn't have any right to treat her like that. That was common practice back then. You know. So that's what that reference there is when it says, he shall give him the daughter of woman, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. She turned against her father. Now remember, this is Daniel writing several centuries before the fact that this was exactly what was going to happen. Okay, let's drop down to verse 20. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Okay, this is a reference to, right here, Seleucus Philopater, who followed Antiochus III, and he was a raiser of taxes and a very harsh taskmaster. But the reason that's important really is just to get to this man. In verse 21, we have our first reference in chapter 11 to Antiochus Epiphanes. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person. That's a reference to Antiochus Epiphanes, and it's a very appropriate reference to him. So now we have the introduction of what Daniel's vision really wanted to get to, the man who would come in and desecrate the temple and would wreak havoc in Jerusalem, as I described to you in chapter 8 when we were there. But let's read just a little bit as we go. Look at verse 24, still talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province. And he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers, and he shall scatter among them prey and spoil riches. His modus operandi was to come in and say, I'm here, I'm in peace, I'm your friend, I'm here to help you. And then as soon as he got his foot in the door, he would wreak havoc. And that's exactly what this man did. In interest of time, drop down to verse 29. This is still talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. At the time appointed, he shall return. This is his fourth assault into Egypt. He shall return and come toward the south, or make another fourth assault, and it shall not be as the former or as the latter, because the ships of Chiton shall come up against him. Now those ships of Chiton are the Roman navy, and some of the more modern translations actually call it the Roman navy. That's that time, remember I told you, where Antiochus Epiphanes was going down to wreak havoc with Egypt, and the Roman general stood right in front of him. Well, he came on a ship. And that's what Daniel sees happening right here. And it was that humiliation that then sparked what we're going to read about in the next few verses. I'll start with verse 30. But the ships of Chiton shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. Now, this man's mad. He's got to get home by coming up through Israel and Palestine, so he stops at Jerusalem and he takes his indignation out against the holy covenant. And he shall even return, having intelligence of them that forsake the holy covenant. Arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, that's the temple, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, that's the Jewish worship, and they shall place an abomination that maketh desolation. That was, I believe, the placing of the swine on the altar in the temple grounds. And we have almost these identical words back in chapter 8, but Daniel's just taking us through it. Again, verse 32, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong. In other words, there will be some people that will stand up to Antiochus Epiphanes. There'll be a remnant of Jews, and this was what we call the Maccabees. It wasn't just the Maccabees, but it was the Maccabees that we think of. And those books that are you've sometimes heard of, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, are about the exploits of the people that stood up to Antiochus Epiphanes. Now verse 34 that says, and when they shall fall, they shall be holpen, or they shall be rather helpless with little help, but many shall cleave to him with flatteries. In other words, there's a small group of people that are going to stand up, but most of the people are going to brown nose Antiochus Epiphanes. And that's history's just full of that, and the world's full of that, and it's disgusting, but it's true. But the king, verse 36, will do according as he wants. Verse 37, he will not regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any guard, for he shall magnify himself above all. This was a man that was almost like Nebuchadnezzar. He thought he was God, an egomaniac. And it says he didn't worship his father's gods, he didn't worship the true God, he was a homosexual in many cases. That's a reference to not having the desire of women. He didn't have any regard for any regard. This guy was just bad. And that's why in verse 21 he's called a vile, vile person. Okay. Let's drop on now down to verse 44. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore, now we're still talking about Antiochus Epiphanes down here. Therefore, he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. Now after the Maccabees had run him out of Jerusalem, he went back to Syria. And in his later years, he began to hear of conflicts to the east. So he took an army to the east to try to squelch those conflicts. And it was in those battles that Antiochus Epiphanes was killed. And that's what he's referring to there in verse 44. News from the east, it troubled him. He therefore went and utterly to make a way, and he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas of the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. In this final battle, nobody was willing to go and help this evil man because he had, in essence, treated everybody like he did the Jews. And this is the history of this vision up to this point of how the Jewish people were going to be persecuted after their captivity by this violent, vile man. Okay. Questions or comments through chapter 11? I know I had to cherry pick a little.
Most culture came through Alexander the Great. This has very little to do with Greece. It's just kind of remnants of that and struggles.
That's right.
Greece and we're dealing with.
That's right. Yeah, at this point, what we call Greece or Athens today was an intellectual, cultural center, but it was not a military might. And the Bible here is following primarily the military might. But these military armies were the ways this culture was spread. Okay? They would go in and conquer the country, and then the Greek language and the Greek culture would follow that. So that when Christ came, the world was largely Hellenized or Greekized, however you want to say it. There were still philosophers in Athens philosophizing, but they didn't have any military power. And that's what people admired at this stage, probably what they still admire, if the truth be known. Any other comments or questions?